what to say about the undescribable, ungraspable. Better to be quiet. But I'm really happy to see all of you again. It's really nice. It feels a long time ago, but then also not. It's somehow strange. I can't even remember when I was here last time. But, yeah, still. There is a bond or a connection. And I'm really looking forward to explore this text with you. And I'm happy that many of you I know since a lot of years, and you're still hanging in there. So there is also in myself, I think, more trust and capacity to go into paradox and contradict myself and leaving the evenings with a sense that I couldn't say what I wanted to say because I can't. So the subject matter or the invitation of this text is non-duality. It is exploring the possibility to awake from the illusion of separation, to awake from the illusion of a separate solid I, to awake from the identification with the narrative self and all its suffering and struggle and aggression and violence and addiction. Into, sort of awake from, confusion into what word one can choose, many words. Also in this text, metaphors. The Tibetan word would be rigpa. Unconditioned awareness, pure awareness. Essence love. Your true self. And the radical message in this text is that right now, in this moment, we have everything available to be complete. So now when I say a sentence like that, at this very moment, you have everything available to be complete. Don't try to understand that. So the way to relate to these teachings and to this text is to listen with your whole body, with your whole heart, and to be curious about your response. Right now, in this moment, you have everything available to be complete. Listen inside, what comes up for you? If you don't refer to your conceptual mind, if you don't refer to thoughts, if you don't refer to what you've learned, if you don't refer to spiritual, religious, scientific knowledge, what does your heart say? So something in you, deep, you know, below the layers of all the hopes and fears, below the layers of the identification, what you think you are, is there something which says, maybe quite loudly, yes, I know. Finally, I hear that. Or maybe it is just a faint whisper, like a memory from childhood, where education and culture have not screwed up your being. Where you were more deeply connected with your natural self. So this is the way how to read this text. Your conceptual mind, your knowledge, is in this matter useless. And this is the big challenge in this text. To dare, to have the willingness, the courage to go beyond what you know, to cut through it. This text belongs to an approach within the Dzogchen tradition, which is called treksho, cutting through. Cutting through the projections, stories, identifications, looking through. And this is scary because even right now, probably you notice that your mind goes into thoughts, into discussion, into trying to understand, into comparing. Maybe into something which is completely unrelated. Maybe it is related, what I'm saying. So notice how deep your refuge is into thinking. And how precious these moments are maybe even a split of a second where there's a gap. And you're just here. Just this. Without referring to thoughts, without referring to meaning giving. And this process can go deeper and deeper and deeper. Because initially, we are not even aware that the sense of separation we have is just a thought. It is meaning giving. It's a conceptual aspect of our mind which creates the sense of separation. Without that layer of projections, there would be no reactivity. There would be no violence coming from here. There would be nothing here to defend. Because it is seen that separation is a projection, a function of the conceptual mind. So cutting through to all of that. In other words, this text is an invitation to, it's so difficult to say anything, it's amazing. An invitation to discover who you are without referring to thoughts. So, who are you without referring to thoughts? I don't understand this, it's just a thought. I don't know what he's talking about, it's just a thought. Of course, any memory connected with the past is just a thought. Your name is just a thought. I'm like this and that is just a thought. Even I'm tired, I'm bored, I'm peaceful is just a thought. And I can see your eyes go there, and they go there. You looked into thoughts. You look into thoughts. And you miss yourself. You miss yourself. How could we ever think that we are thoughts? How could we ever think that we are feelings? Because they come and go. They change all the time. There's nothing solid, nothing you can hold on in feelings and thoughts. So who are you without referring to thoughts? It's okay, since we have not stabilized our mind through meditation, or maybe we are not very skilled in that, that doesn't matter, thoughts can happen. Just don't look there, look to yourself. I mean, imagine you could manage, like for a moment, not to have any thought. You would be still here. look there. To that I am-ness, which is prior to any thought. And then realize that even I am is just a thought. Another way to describe this movement provisionally, but it's a helpful pointer for some people, is to bring attention back to itself. Usually our attention goes to thoughts. But where does the attention come from? What's the source? The source of your attention, which is also the source of your capacity to love, to care. So in this journey now, meeting this text, we become more and more curious about that which is thinking and not what's the content of the thoughts. For this moment to become possible, you really, really need to get up, need to let go, give up this hope that what you are seeking is found in thought. That what you're really yearning for is found in thought. Even if it's a wonderful spiritual thought, a wonderful spiritual story, to really give that up, to have seen that. I can have the most wonderful novel in my head about reality and karma and how everything functions and so on. That's just a thought. It's not going to quench the thirst. It's not home. It's not safe. It's not a refuge. Instead, this text invites us to take refuge into stillness. Into a non-conceptual knowing. So one challenge with this text is our addiction to figure things out. Of course, we can understand the sentence emptiness, prajnaparamita, non-duality, the nature of your mind, rigpa, is indescribable, ungraspable. We can understand that sentence. Yeah, okay, it's ungraspable, it's undescribable. But what is it? Waiting for a conceptual answer. Reading another book, another non-dual book, another book about emptiness. And again, reading in that book, It's undescribable. It's ungraspable. Yeah, I've heard that before, but I still haven't understood it. Yes! It's not understandable. But it's knowable. Even that is a bit too much to say it's knowable. So that's why this is sometimes called not knowing. The other challenge, which we will come across in our being while we are listening to this text, is our addiction to doing, to fixing, to getting somewhere. Our addiction to self-development. Our addiction, particular, to get out, to get from spiritual practice something for me. To feel better. To be more successful, to be more healthy, for me. And I guess most of us here, we have at least let go of some of the projects in our life, in the sense of that we see that these projects, none of these projects will bring us into completion. None of these projects will make us genuinely happy. The relationship project, the career project, the health project. So because we are old enough, probably, to have tried a few things, and we have also seen our parents failing. But, and I'm not saying that means we give up all these projects. Yeah? So that's not what I mean here. It's just giving up the hope that they will bring us home, that any of these projects will be complete and will make us complete once we succeeded in that project. But probably what we will have to confront when we meet this text is the spiritual project. The progressive path. The idea of training. The sense that I'm not good enough. Something is missing. And that something I can get in the future. If I'm a good boy and a good girl and I do the steps and I do this and that and I do the 100,000 of that and I do all these studies and then I learn Tibetan. This is particularly difficult for people who invested many, many years into this project. So, when we work with this text and we listen to these invitations, yeah, be aware of those two parts of you, the doer and the thinker. How do they feel? Where do they come up? Be curious about them. Make them part of this journey. It could be that one of the most important orientations which we need when we make this journey with this text is an uncompromising intention to wake up. And to wake up not in a distant future or in a next life, but to wake up in this life. And of course, waking up can be described on different levels and there's many different shifts and insights, and we will look into that. But do you have an uncompromising determination to be free of suffering in this life? Meaning, you have an intuition, a trust, that is actually possible. And not only possible for Tibetans and for the special people, but possible for you, for the messed up you, for the stupid you. So an uncompromising intention, intuition, which when you feel into it, you might acknowledge it as something which has been there since a long time, maybe since childhood or as a teenager, where the first time a call awoke in you, a sense of being called, but also a call from inside. And then periods in our life where we don't listen to that call anymore, where we disregard it. And now, especially now, because we enter this text, we know each other, we bring together as a group meditative experience into this journey. Enough knowledge, enough practice. We have done the groundwork. We have done the Lamrim. We have done bodhicitta. We have done Kriya Yoga Tantra practice. It's enough. So now is the time to really get into that passion to prioritize awakening, meaning liberation from suffering. Not liberation from pain, not liberation from difficult feelings, not liberation from sickness, old age, and death. Liberation from suffering. And then not only that, but liberation from suffering for the benefit of all. So that is a very important orientation. And if that is not available for you, that's fine. Maybe it will awaken throughout the journey with this text. Or it will be rekindled. So that's one point. like a general orientation. The second, trust your intuition. And here, intuition, again, not up here, but a deep, silent intuition. It's time to rely more upon the quiet knowingness in your own being than any book, any teacher, anything what anyone says, including me, of course. That's not so difficult, I guess, but even texts like that, rely on your intuition. Because the very foundation of this invitation in this text is the assumption that awakening is already here. Awakeness is already here. Nobody can give it to you. It's not found in books. It's not, no teacher can give it to you. It's not found in other places. It's also not found in other life circumstances. And it's also, it's so important to listen to the whispers in your heart, the whispers in your capacity to love everything, because it seems for me that the process of awakening is different for everyone. So the third orientation is a willingness, a ruthless willingness to feel all your feelings. And to be radical, authentic with that. This is so important, to make a commitment. Not only the commitment to awakening, but also the commitment, I will be radically loyal to my feelings. Particularly the unspiritual feelings. One reason for that is, I talked about spiritual bypassing before, it's easy to, for the narrative self, for the neurotic self, to use teachings on one non-duality and non-self, just to not be who you are, and not to be authentic who you are, and not to be loyal to your greed, to your addiction, to the many things which are coming out, which you are ashamed of, or you're not even become aware of because it's so embarrassing. But the other reason is, it seems that in this process of awakening, where we let go of our defense mechanism, that unfelt feeling emerge. So this process of cutting through our projections into the experience of non-duality obviously is the most meaningful and the most beautiful, the most relieving, the most healing, the most liberating experience. But it's also the most difficult, the most challenging. Nobody ever regretted it, but actually some people want to think, to check, do you really want to break your heart open? Do you really want that? And if the answer is yes, get over it quickly. Don't drag it along. So I'm not expecting that we will finish this text. I don't think we will get to the title today. And I guess we will continue with that pace. We can continue next year or if we are not going to the text. And if it's possible for you, and if you find that connection with that text, then regard this text as a life's companion. You know, something which you have around, something you refer to again and again, something which is a source of inspiration, a source of reminders. And I said that before, but don't regard this text as a source for information, as a source for understanding. We have covered that. You know enough. You know enough about the Buddhist teachings. There is not much more. I mean, of course, Geluk tradition, they go so complicated. You can spend your whole life reading text and studying. But most of us here, we have received the basic teachings. That's it. We don't need to put 10 more years of studying yet another Lamrim text. It's the same. Yeah. So this text can be seen actually as your own Buddha nature, your own knowingness speaking to you. Now the title of the root text, which is written by Jingme Lingpa in the 18th century, is called Revelation of Ever-Present Good. Revelations of Ever-Present Good. I mean, just ever-present good is a word to kind of, you know... It's like, I mean, if you would see this text as a source of information, you would just read, okay, this is a text, this is a title, Revelations of Ever-Present Good. So what is it about? Yeah. But actually, this is like a mantra which we can sing, which we can dwell in, not understanding. I mean, of course, we can now discuss, yeah, ever-present good. Yeah, so what's with the war? What's with the concentration camps? Not like that, yeah? Ever-present good. And maybe this doesn't resonate with you. So it's a lot about resonance. So the transmission happens through resonance, not through understanding. So maybe ever-present good, revelations of ever, it's like, for me, it's like, wow. It's like revelations of ever-present good. Yeah, maybe for you it's nothing. Yeah, but hopefully there will be a word, a metaphor, a poem in this text which will resonate with what is already awake in you. Of course, in one way, when I talk, but also when we read the commentary of Ken McCloyd, there is a bit of talk to the narrative self as well, to the one who wants to know and the one who wants to do something, and the one who wants to get something out of this for me. Yeah? So there is a bit of that. And it's also probably this one who brought you here. Yeah? But actually, that's not the audience for this text. It's just a bystander who gets a bit of candies so that it stays. Yeah? A bit of hope. Yeah, I'm saying there's nothing in you for, there is nothing here for you, but actually there is. Something like that, yeah. Because it's liberation, it's freedom for suffering. It's freedom from suffering. So the I as a separate I likes to hear that and stays around. But this is not the real audience. The real audience of this text is that which is already awake. And entering this text is like entering what is connecting, is listening to your own Buddha nature, to your own awakeness. Ever-present good is the translation Ken McCloyd chose for Samantabhadra, the primordial Buddha, Buddha nature. So the title of this text is Revelations of Your Own Buddha Nature, your own radiant, innate wisdom and capacity to love everything. This text has the capacity to be a bit destabilizing. For example, Ken McCloyd, after he taught some of the retreats called Trackless Path, he gave up to be a teacher. He stopped teaching. And he was a known teacher. He was a successful teacher. He could have done that for the rest of his life. He couldn't anymore. He still writes books. He shares through his writings. But he is not teaching anymore. Let's see. So I really recommend you, if you have not already ordered this book, and I have it on my Kindle, but it's because I travel so much, but it's actually good to get a hard copy of this book so that you can have it around and just look at it and keep it as a reminder on your wherever you like to read. I think this is it's worth to get a hard copy of this book. It's called The Trackless Path. Yeah, that's the title Ken McLeod gave to his commentary. And we have a break soon. So the original text is written by Jingmi Lingpa, a mystic from the 18th century, who spent most of his life in retreat. What is interesting, one of the things interesting about his life, he is self-taught. He didn't study, so he's not like a scholar. And Ken McLeod says that it shows in his writings. He uses a bit more intimate, a bit more direct, not like scholarly loaded language. And when we read this text, keep in mind these are poems. So what that means is, no, what a poem does or tries to do is to transmit an experience from the poet to the one who is reading. And maybe you are someone who has difficulties to read poems. Maybe you're not interested in them because they don't make sense. They don't make sense to the rational mind. Or maybe you're someone who doesn't like to look at paintings and just marveling at the experience and being there in a non-conceptual experience of the music or the art or the architecture. So, yeah, it's good to see that we all have our talents and our obstacles. So when we read this poem, I mentioned it already. The most important thing here to be curious about is what is happening in you. What is happening in you if I say revelations of ever-present good? So Jingmi Lingpa is seen as an incarnation of another Tibetan mystic, Longchenpa, who lived in the 14th century. And these two together, they framed or they influenced the structure of the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Mainly, I mean, they are the two main pillars of the Nyingma tradition. And it seems that, I don't know if it's true for this poem, but that a lot of the Jingma Lingpa's writings are seen as discoveries of tamas, is the Tibetan word, mind treasures, which the mind stream of Longshengpa carried through the centuries until that mind stream embodies itself in the life of Jingma Lingpa, carrying these mind treasures in him. And then it was the time for them to be discovered by Jingma Lingpa, but they are kind of written by Longshengpa, not written in a physical form. So Jingma Lingpa is what in the Tibetan tradition is called a tertön. People, mystics, who have the capacity to discover these mind treasures, these hidden texts. But I'm not sure if that is true for this poem. Maybe not. This poem seems to be more a spontaneous sharing of Jingma Lingpa of his experience of non-duality. What makes this translation particularly accessible to us is that it was translated by Ken MacLeod. Because Ken MacLeod is one of those translators who is more committed to transmit the experience which is expressed in the poem than being true to the original words, which is also a valuable way to translate a text, to kind of be a tight ass around what the words mean and to be true to that. But of course, in poems, it's a different thing. Yeah, to translate in another language into another culture a poem, much more is needed than knowing the words. And Ken MacLeod dares to do that based on his whole life of prioritizing in that passion which I mentioned in the beginning, the intention to wake up, the intention to what the willingness to make that knowing, this particular way of knowing, the main thing in his life. So based on that, he dares to transmit to us, in his translation, the experience of Jingma Lingpa of non-duality, of our true nature.